are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 31st, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, professor at Vermont Law School, Jennifer Taub, author of Other People's Houses, on the rolling regulatory crisis we seem to have in this country. Also on the program, we are chock-a-block. Indictments. Well, metaphorically speaking. Andrew Cuomo receives a letter from the U.S. attorney from the Southern District of Manhattan saying, stop tampering with witnesses. That is a no-no. Also, the CIA just weeks ago claiming we never spied on the U.S. Senate is now told by their own inspector general, you spied on the U.S. Senate. Someone at the Department of Justice should answer their phones. Meanwhile, the CIA torture report is imminent, and it doesn't look good. President Obama about to sign another executive order regarding the employment practices of federal contractors. Israel has now displaced nearly one quarter of the population in Gaza. And Dick Morris has a new venture. I had to throw that in there. I'm trying to lighten this up a little bit. The U.S. House votes to sue President Obama. For what? We'll figure that out. And the FBI's forensic failures most likely sent at least one person to their death and keeps many more in prison. NSA, they got 700,000. We got 700,000 people on the watch list. They missed the one guy who flew back from Syria, then flew back to Syria to engage in a suicide bombing. All that and more on today's program. We missed that one. Should have been 701. We've got a lot to talk about today. This Cuomo thing, this looks pretty serious. But before we do, we will talk to Jennifer Taub. She is a professor at the Vermont Law School on a wonderful book that shows that we've had these regulatory problems when it comes to banks and mortgages for a long time leading up to the 2008 crisis. Just a reminder, it is your membership that makes this show possible. You keep this show going. If you're not a member and you can afford to be, please join today at majority.fm Also, don't forget, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. You go there, you click on the link, you bookmark the Amazon link. You always use that to buy your Amazon crap. We get a kickback, hence majorityreportkickback.com. Or you do it as a one-off. All right, folks, be back in a moment with Jennifer Taub. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Jennifer Taub, the professor of law at Vermont Law School, teaching contracts, corporations, securities regulation, and white collar crime, and the author of Other People's Houses. Welcome to the program, Jennifer.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Sam.
So your book follows the story of the Noblemans, a family that really sort of, I guess you choose to kick off one of the aspects of the bankruptcy code. And I found this fascinating because from a political standpoint, the first disappointment that I can recall with the Obama administration was their failure to push for what we call the cram down. So let's and this was one of the first indications that the president was not going to sort of follow up on some promises, and a really important one in coming out of the financial crisis of 2008. But tell us about the Noblemen case.
Sure. And just for a moment, just for your listeners, before I jump into the Nobleman story, that term cram down is this pejorative label that we all use as shorthand to describe when a homeowner who's underwater on their mortgage tries to go into the bankruptcy court and use the bankruptcy process for what it was designed to do, which is to get them a fresh start. In particular, what's meant by cram down is when a court looks at the amount the house is worth, and when that's less than the outstanding loan balance on the mortgage, reduces that loan balance down to the fair market value of the house. And to be clear, this practice of reducing debt is what bankruptcy does. And for all manner of other assets, even including boats and cars and second homes, the bankruptcy judges are free to do that.
So, just to be clear, so the point you're making here is that cram down was a term to make it seem like this was something beyond the typical bankruptcy, right? As opposed to a deficiency in Chapter 13 bankruptcies, this was it was supposed to make it sound like this was something extra that we were giving homeowners.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, that term cram down is often used to describe a different part of bankruptcy that happens with commercial bankruptcy. But it was, you know, that label slapped on to it, and it kind of stuck. And where this prohibition comes from, where your home is singled out, where homeowners are not given the same kind of access to the fresh start, at, you know, with regard to their home as you know businesses are with regard to their assets or people who have a vacation home. Where that prohibition came from is this case called Noblemen versus American Savings Bank, and that brings us to that couple, Leonard and Harriet Noblemen.
And this is back in 1993. So basically, tell us the story of that couple.
Yeah, I really love to. So their case went to the Supreme Court in 1993 and was decided that year as well. How they got there, though, is a pretty sad story. They were a middle-class couple from Dallas, Texas. They had a grown daughter, and they were looking to downsize. And so they decided they were going to buy a one-bedroom condo. And they saw that in far north Dallas, there was a new development being built, you know, the kind of condo complex that has a small clubhouse and a pool and a cluster of semi-attached, you know, wooden brick buildings. They selected their unit. It was a ground floor, as I mentioned, one bedroom, one bath, I think one and a half bath unit. And they purchased this in the summer of 1984. And it turned out it was actually incredibly bad timing, because what was happening right at that moment was a condo bubble in the, you know, sort of general broader Dallas area. And this bubble was due to there was this kind of overbuilding that was happening, and prices were being inflated. It's very strange, but one of the reasons why prices were so high at the time they purchased their condo, and they bought it for about $71,000. They were so high because there was a massive condo fraud scheme happening east of them that kind of affected prices everywhere. There was a there were some savings and loans, in particular one called Empire Savings and Loan, that due to a lot of deregulation, early deregulation of savings and loans in Texas, moved out of the stuff that used to do. Back in the old days, savings and loans were like the building and loan in It's a Wonderful Life, where they were restricted to taking in deposits and making residential mortgage loans. Texas had really loosened up in the late 70s, early 80s, and they were allowing these savings and loans that had no previous expertise or legal ability to start doing building development type loans. And so what ended up happening is this particular bank, Empire Savings and Loans, and some other similar savings and loans were pretty much co-opted and controlled by some builders. And one of these builders, who's still famous in that area today, was a guy named Danny Faulkner. Mm-hmm. And he had, you know, these kind of, he'd done one successful building project that he named after himself that still exists, called Faulkner Point, on a man-made lake called Lake Bay Hubbard. And he got this idea that he, that worked well. So now they wanted to build, you know, thousands of condos across the I-30 corridor that kind of runs east-west out to that lake. And at any rate, there was this the way they were making money is they were flipping land so that, you know, friends of the bank would buy, someone would borrow from this savings and loan, or other friends of it, borrowed money, purchase some land, and then sell it to somebody else at an inflated price. That very same day, they would line up these tables in a building, like an office hallway, and there would be, you know, five tables in a row, and you'd start at the first table, and you would sell the land to somebody, and then they'd raise the price, and the bank would loan them the next loan. And so they would take this bigger loan and pay off the first person. They were just flipping this piece of land several, you know, maybe five or six times in a single, you know, afternoon, so that by the time it was flipped at the end, now this loan, the bank now had a fraudulently inflated, you know, not fair market value, a ton of money loaned against a piece of property that really wasn't worth it. And these are the kind of land that they were going to be using to develop these condos on. And yeah, at any rate,
well, this, no, I want to, you know, because this story of Danny Faulkner, I still am trying to sort of like can see, like understand how that works. So and then I want to go back to also this notion of what happens when a builder controls their own bank in a way, because it seems to me that you lose all of the sort of checks and balances that are supposed to exist in that dynamic that prevents bad loans from being made. But so they would have a piece of land, they would sell it to somebody, and they would find, and the bank would, and Faulkner owned the land at the beginning. He would sell it to Bill Stevens, whatever it is.
How about I sell it to you? How about I get a loan from Empire, you know, and I get a loan for $1 million, and I go out and buy several parcels of land. Then I sell it to you for $5 million. Where are you going to get the $5 million from? You get it from that same bank or another bank. Okay, so you pay me $5 million. I pay off my loan. I just made $4 million. Now you owe $5 million, and a minute later, you sell that same parcel for $8 million. To your friend.
Didn't somebody realize they'd be the last guy holding the bag, though, right? I mean, it's
a apologies. Well, you know who the last guy holding the bag was? The federal government. They precursed for the savings and loans. They used to have not an FDIC, but it was the FSLIC. It was their the federal insurer, and it was them that ended up in the end. And what's amazing about this particular bank, there are a lot of them in cahoots, but this particular bank, before this all started, before they got into this, and it was like 1980, that this all happened like between 1982 and 1984. Like in 1982, before it became corrupted, all this bank had was about $17 million in customer deposits. It was a little bank in a strip mall. And it was, you know, making normal loans, car loans, home loans, and so on. In 2 years, it ballooned in size to like over $300 million. And this is the other thing. So what's interesting about this, you know, it's kind of intriguing to imagine these land flips. And you can see the incentives for why people were flipping the land and then these condo projects and, you know, the promise of making money. But where was the money coming from? Because, you know, how do you go from $17 million to fund what you're doing up to over $300 million? And they got this money. It was called, the process is often called hot money. It was called brokered deposits, where the types of banks that were in the brokered deposit business were banks like Merrill Lynch. The big money, big, you know, brokers out of New York would bunch up money into CDs, jumbo CDs, and give them to these banks. And these banks were paying out huge interest because they were getting, you know, doing really well at first and charging a lot of interest. I mean, they weren't just doing land flips. They're also making crazy loans to, you know, starry-eyed developers and charging them huge interest. And the interest money would come in at first. Everything would work in the first year because you would loan them enough money against a project that was going to eventually fail. But you'd give them enough that you set aside the first interest payment.
Right.
So everything looks really good.
So a year. So I'm the last guy. I'm the last guy who buys that piece of land. And I've borrowed enough, or the bank has loaned me enough, so that I can pay off my first year of interest and still walk away with a profit. And then at one point, I basically say, "I'm done. I don't have any more money to pay you." And then the bank is holding the bag for these bad loans. They have to basically go under. And then this FDIC like agency comes in and pays off essentially all the debt that the bank has.
Exactly. And then one other piece of it, that last guy holding the land before we get the government rescue, last guy holding the land might be someone who's also then trying to subdivide it to make it into condos. So then you get these other people that you try to get into the game. You tell other people, hey, come on in, and if you buy this, you know, if you buy this land, and you can also borrow from us to help buy the building materials. So you ended up also along this corridor with these, they called them Martian landing paths. And you can, I was down there and looked at these and walked around. It's kind of very eerie where you have these cement foundation pads and, you know, overgrown with weeds and things that never actually got built on. And there are other sort of uninhabited buildings that eventually did get knocked down, that, you know, so there were all these either empty spaces or unbuilt properties also. So you have that as well. But yeah, so at the end of the day, it was, you know,
so bank owns this property, yeah, that's worth a fraction of what the last sale was for.
Right.
And they can't recoup any of that, or they pennies on the dollar at that point.
And plus, the stuff that got, there were some condos that got built, right? And so those condos, some of those that were supposed to be actually purchased, the way this was supposed to work out, if it weren't fraudulent and if people actually didn't ignore the fact that the area was already overbuilt, the way it was going to work out is that you'd get someone to buy the condo units, right? But the problem was there weren't enough buyers for the units that actually got built. There weren't enough buyers. And so then this is where we get the noblemen. So why? They buy their condo, summer of 84, for $71,000. And that fall, the Dallas Appraisal District basically was over 1,000 condos in the Dallas area got reclassified from owner-occupied to rentals. And when that happened, they on average dropped about $20,000 in value, but some dropped more. So this is when I said they had very bad luck. They were really indirect victims of this, you know, condo fraud that inflated values at the time, because there was this idea that these would all be valued at as owner-occupied. So their condo plummeted in value to about being worth about $23,500, but they still owed over $65,000 on it.
And they couldn't, presumably, they, I guess they couldn't sell the house that they were supposedly moving out of, or they had other problems that forced them into bankruptcy at that point.
That's what happened, right? So we're talking 84, right? So this is 84. They kind of moved along with their lives, but then come, you know, around winter, you know, fall to early winter, around November of 89, a lot of other trouble was happening in the area. Harriet lost her job when her insurance company went through a restructuring. And Leonard, who was also in insurance at the time, was suffering greatly from diabetes and losing his sight, and he was unemployed. And so they kind of, at that point, were trying to figure out what they could do, and they reached out to the company that had made them the loan, who actually no longer held their loan. The person who extended the loan was still servicing it, and the same entity was called Murray, that they were making their payments to. And they said, you know, look, we've heard about other people in our complex who've had restructurings negotiated. Could you restructure our mortgage? And they said no. And that's why they went into bankruptcy court in the summer of 1990. I think it was the day before their home was about to be sold through foreclosure.
And the Supreme Court ultimately decided, what was the reasoning behind this? I mean, why would the Supreme Court say, we're not going to afford homeowners the same rights, essentially, or privileges, or however it is deemed, under bankruptcy as we would if you were, I don't know, a 7-Eleven or whatnot?
Yeah, that's a great question. So their two lawyers, one of whom is Rosemary Zine, came up to the Supreme Court, and actually when argued the case all the way from bankruptcy up through the Federal District Court, the Fifth Circuit Court, and then up to the Supreme Court, taking the position that this should be treated similar to other types of loans. And she was not alone in her thinking. By the time the Supreme Court heard their case, if you were a homeowner in more than 20 states, you would be able to do this, to go in and say, look, I still owe $65,000, and I would, you know, I only, the house is only worth $28,500. The plan, just to be clear, the plan they had was, so they were doing a Chapter 13, which is, people are probably familiar with a Chapter 7, which is your basic liquidation for a consumer or a business. But when you do a restructuring, a business files for Chapter 11, and a restructuring, a consumer will file for Chapter 13. And what that is, just like a business, you often hear they came out of bankruptcy and the business is now running again. The same thing for a homeowner. It's meant to be a fresh start, and you get a 3 to 5 year plan usually, and you come up with a plan with how you're gonna pay your creditors. And the way it usually works is there's two types of creditors for whether you're a consumer borrower like you and I, or you're a business. You can take out a loan that's either secured or not secured. And the easiest way to think of this is a loan that's secured is something that's backed by collateral.
Right.
But a loan that's not secured is just an IOU. And so the court is supposed to sort through these things. And with most secured loans, the court will say, okay, it's only secured up to the value of the collateral. This is where the so-called cram down comes into play. Their lawyers came in, the nobleman's lawyers came into the Supreme Court saying, you know, look, this is happening across the country. Only the Fifth Circuit Court, which Texas is within the Fifth Circuit, only the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is rejecting this idea. And the Supreme Court affirmed the Fifth Circuit. And getting back to your question, their reasoning is, without getting too arcane here, there were two competing provisions of the bankruptcy code. And depending on what order you apply the provisions, one side would win or one side would lose. And the noblemen's believe that the first thing you should do is take a look at their lender and say, well, the house is only worth $23,500, so you're only secured to that amount. What the bank, American Savings Bank, wanted to do, though, was say, no, no, you don't look at that provision first. You look at this language that truthfully was put in by the banking lobby into the bankruptcy code in 1978. There's a special language that has this sort of parenthetical that says judges in Chapter 13 can restructure loans except for those that are only secured by what's called a first lien, so like a first mortgage on a primary residence. And they looked at that and said, look, this is protecting the full amount of the loan, not just that piece that's still secured by the collateral. And again, it's amazing when you look at the Supreme Court decision. It's so highly technical that you don't find anything out about the homeowners whatsoever. I really had to dig into the National Archives, their bankruptcy files, speak with their daughter, dig into all kinds of records in order to really find out what happened here.
And to bring this up to 2008, the reason why this ruling was so important and the reason why this was a hotly debated political topic, even in the 2008 election about the so-called cram down, was because we were left with millions of people essentially in the nobleman's position following the 2008 financial crisis.
That's right. Even today, depending on the you know who's counting, there are between 6 to 9 million homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages today. And this was obviously far worse right when prices after the housing bubble burst began to really collapse. And what happened is, there was even before, during, you might remember this, but during the presidential campaign back in 2008, once Barack Obama was the nominee for the Democrats and John McCain for the Republicans, one of the discussions on the campaign trail was this very issue, bankruptcy reform to help underwater homeowners.
Because at this point, we were starting to see that the housing market was starting to collapse. And at the very least, what we understood at that time was you had a lot of people who were in underwater mortgages, which means that they don't have the ability to move because they can't sell their house without actually paying money out. When you're underwater, so people just understand this. When you're underwater with your mortgage, it's not just a question of, oh, we lost our house payments or we're going to sell it for less than we bought it. You literally have to come up with cash to pay to sell your house because you have to pay off the mortgage. And people can't do that.
Exactly. And so people couldn't move. If they lost their job, they were stuck because they couldn't move to a new location. Also, we're seeing this has been a tailwind on the economic recovery. We're still seeing this between this and student loan debt. We're seeing, I think Neil Irwin, it was in the New York Times a couple months ago, cited a study about this missing, is it between 1 to 2 million or so, the missing buyers. You know, the people in that demographic who would be first-time home buyers who can't even begin to do that. Plus, we obviously have people who've owned their homes for a long time, but not long enough to have paid off their mortgage, who can't even do the downsizing they might want to do as they're reaching retirement. So we don't have people who should be retiring about now giving up their jobs. It's a really vicious cycle.
So
and
now,
this did come up. Sorry, go ahead.
So assume for a moment that either in 93 that decision was the Supreme Court made a different decision, or assume that in 2009 this bankruptcy reform included what really should have just been a normal provision of bankruptcy. You have this probably the biggest asset that you have in most instances, and your creditors who are in line, secured first, non-secured second, they are at get-go at the start of figuring out how you're going to sort of get some debt relief. It would start with the notion that you owe the bank what your collateral is worth at that time, not what it was years ago. Assuming that provision had passed in the Senate, what would be the implications of that? It wouldn't just be that a lot of people go to bankruptcy and get unwound. It meant it would have changed how banks would have reacted to consumers.
Yeah, I mean,
to homeowners.
You know, I agree with you. We can only speculate, but what I imagine is exactly what you're saying. It's called bargaining in the shadow of bankruptcy, and it's what all creditors do in a commercial context. And what it would have meant is we might have avoided all those foreclosure mills, and we might have avoided what we see about that dual tracking that happened, where people would, you know, through these, they're supposed to help through HAMP and all these other programs, help people restructure, and then on their dual track, they say, okay, don't make these payments, it's fine. And then they suddenly say, well, you know, you do that trial payment, but we don't think you're a good candidate for restructuring, and then separately foreclose on them. Or all the backlog or missing papers. The beauty of the bankruptcy process is twofold. First, you can bargain in the shadow of bankruptcy so that these banks would have the incentive to hire enough people to avoid that process.
Because they know they're going to go into they could end up in bankruptcy court, and they could basically just get the value of the house, the market rate of the house as it is, and that's what they're trying to avoid in the first place, theoretically, right?
And it's no joking. You know, you can't joke around with a bankruptcy court judge.
Right.
None of these shenanigans. You can't just not call the judge back or not show up. And this is, you know, the other thing though is if the consumer files, it stops the clock. Gives them some breathing room. And now, completely the balance of power has shifted at that moment. Did you file for bankruptcy? Now, the ball's in the bank's court to do something so they can start getting paid again. And there's someone actually watching over and making sure these documents are accurate and so on. It would have made such a difference.
It would have made a huge difference. All right, but now let's go back. And then, you know, because as we hear the case of what was taking place in Texas at that time, and my understanding is that Texas was sort of one of those, was the model for deregulation of the savings and loans, which then ultimately brought us the savings and loans crisis. And the you talk about in the book how basically – we see the same regulators making more or less the same mistakes, even from the mid to late 80s, in the early 80s, through the aughts, essentially, when it comes to the banks. Talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, this is – so what's really fascinating, and I'm, you know, really happy that we started where we did with our discussion, is when I was looking at the Nobleman case, I was just trying to dig into it to better understand, you know, what was the story behind this. I was very curious. And in doing that, it was inevitable that I started to look at all the parties, not just the borrowers, but the banks. Maybe we'll get to that some other time, but also the regulators. And what kind of amazed me was that the various regulators – the regulator that was supposed to, there were state regulators, but the federal regulator that oversaw that insurance fund we talk about for the savings and loan, the one that had jurisdiction because deposit insurance existed. Let me just back up with that regulator. So even though, you know, we have a dual banking system and we had a dual savings and loan system, which meant you could choose whether you wanted to be a state regulated or a federal regulated savings and loan. But even the state regulated savings and loan, like this Texas savings and loan, Empire savings and loan, even though it followed Texas law, which had loosened up on what it could do with its money and loosened up on how much it could get in these dangerous brokered deposits that could come in and out very fast, it loosened up on both ends of the balance sheet, the state regulator. But even so, this Texas savings and loan got the benefit of federal insurance. Federal government's insurance. So there was some jurisdiction as well at the federal level. So what was this federal regulator doing? As it turns out, not much, because for a number of reasons, it was moving offices, it was understaffed, and it sort of had this policy of forbearance and too much trust, I believe. You know, if the numbers look good, and the numbers were good without really scratching the surface enough and looking at the warning signs. And so the federal regulator was called the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. It's a long name. So this Federal Home Loan Bank Board, though, you know, Empire was the first one to fail, first big bank to fail first savings loan to fail due to fraud in the crisis, and it failed in March of 1984. But then we get, that was just early, right, because the savings and loan failures went on and on really through the Reagan administration, through late 88, through all these massive rescues. And then in 1989, when George Bush Sr. takes office, is when he does this big cleanup and supposedly reform legislation at that time. And as part of this legislation that was called FERIA, they purportedly abolished this failed regulator called the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. But what really actually happened is they just took the name off the wall. I mean, they broke up some of it, broke parts of it up, but really the main part of it just changed its name to the Office of Thrift Supervision, or OTS. And what you might remember is this Office of Thrift Supervision was the regulator of choice. When banks, not only can you change from being a federal or state savings and loan or bank, but you can also, you know, change regulators. And it turns out that this Office of Thrift Supervision, the reincarnation or the change name of this failed SNL regulator, was the regulator of IndyMac, Washington Mutual,
yes,
American AIG, International
right.
Group.
Yeah. Right.
Yep.
And so now, and explain this to people that I don't think people are aware of the fact that the banks could choose which agency was going to regulate them, basically based upon, you know, it's like shopping for a B, I guess, when you're in college, right? I'm going to take the professor who I know. I just have to show up once or twice to a lecture, and everybody does well. That's basically what they were doing, right?
Hey, let's be clear. I'm not that professor.
No, I understand. I was not claiming that at all. But that's the dynamic there, right? And Alan Greenspan was saying that this is a positive because what was Alan Greenspan's justification for allowing this sort of like regulatory shopping? Like, I'm going to choose who's going to be my parole officer or something.
He believed it would create competition among regulators so they wouldn't over-regulate.
So in other words, he believed that it would create a race to the bottom in terms of less supervision. The easier you are, the better, the more business you will get as a regulator. It is completely upside down in terms of, I mean,
to be fair to him, you and I might call that a race to the bottom. He would have called that a race to the top.
Right. Yes. But I never had to go in front of the Senate and say my entire perspective on how these things work was probably misguided, like he did at the end of the day. But so, all right. So let's jump up. We don't have too much more time here, but let's jump up to 2008. I mean, and I know you've written about Dodd-Frank. It seems to me that what is clear throughout your book is just that there is no way to really regulate these entities in the way or if past experience is any indicator of future results, I guess, that actually having regulations that are sort of micro-targeted doesn't make as much sense in the final analysis as broad statutes that reform the system and prevent it from being, when any given player collapses, from taking the whole system down. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we need – I completely agree with you. I think kind of broad structural reform for prevention – and then also strengthening the intervention tools so that if a large player collapses, it doesn't create contagion. We just don't have enough of prevention right now. And it's, some of this is related to the rhetoric where people mistakenly think the banking system is part of the free market. You know, if you know, these banks get the benefit of taxpayer-backed federal deposit insurance, that's not a free market. The minute you're fueling an institution and funding it in a way that has a special federal safety net, that's not free market. Banking is different from other businesses. And so I think part of the rhetoric around this interferes with the ability to really look at how it's structured and the benefits it gets. And I think that, I really admire what Jack Reed, who was a former head of Citigroup, has repeatedly said, which is these large banks now that are bigger now than they were before the crisis when they were called too big to fail unless we had to rescue them. These even bigger banks are just too big to manage because, you know, he said that there's just a very big difference between the kind of deposit taking and lending, traditional banking, and this more complex high-stakes investment banking. And that these institutions are giant, you know, too big to manage, they're too big to fail, and we also know they're too big to prosecute.
Yeah, indeed. And so from your perspective, I mean, where do you have a sense of where the next, I mean, there seems to be a certain inevitability that we that we're going to run into another crisis at one point or another. Do you have a sense of where that's going to emanate from? I mean, in the absence of sort of firewalling off different sectors of this financial industry, and knowing that the potential for contagion, as you call it, exists, where might the next crisis emanate out of?
That's a great question. Well, if you look at the commonalities, you know, every crisis, whether it was the run on the banks during the Great Depression, the pulling of funding due to fraud and other issues, abuse and mismanagement of the savings and loan, that hot money issue, or recently, you know, the run was through the short-term wholesale funding market. I think those are still very vulnerable. This is a kind of complex topic that people's eyes roll. But, you know, we think about in the Great Depression, customers lining up around the block to try to get their money out because they didn't, you know, there wasn't deposit insurance. So again, we get to this, you know, that makes people not want to run as customers. And right now, what the 2008 crisis, the run on Bear Stearns and the run on Lehman Brothers, was a run by giant institutional investors and others on the banks through these short-term and overnight funding markets. And there's still trillions of dollars lent through those markets. And this is something that's been, you know, really on the radar screen of the Fed and Treasury. And I hope they get to it to fix that.
Yeah, me too. Jennifer Taub, the book is Other People's Houses. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break and head into the funner half. And it's going to be fun today. It is just crazy. All this stuff that is going down right at the moment. Let's start with Cuomo. I don't think that the U.S. attorney is going to go this far out on a limb and talk about and accuse the Cuomo administration of basically of witness tampering. Unless they think that there's some potential case here. So Andrew Cuomo could be in big trouble. Yet for all we know, we heard from the next governor of New York State yesterday on this program. Also, Israel apparently has lost Joe Scarborough. When Joe Scarborough. So finally, MSNBC.
That is a wow. Michael said that off mic, but I believe that deserves.
Yeah,
the
finally,
wow.
MSNBC criticizing Israel.
Joe Scarborough comes through on the rule of Jabril criticism.
Yeah.
That's pretty stunning.
Yes. Also, this executive order by President Obama. We will talk about this CIA torture report where when the administration is anticipating this report coming out, they seek talking points from different agencies in the government. That's pretty standard. Somehow the AP got its hands on the talking points from the State Department. We don't know that this is ultimately going to be part of the government response, but we get a sense of what state thinks about this report. And it gives us a sense of what's going on in that report. Like I say, the CIA's own inspector general said that they were spying on the Senate. And apparently they're going to appoint Evan Bayh to a committee to tisk the CIA. Unbelievable. Immigration reform, of course, dead. But this emergency funding for this refugee crisis that we have with children coming from Central America, the House can't seem to get their act together to pass anything because Ted Cruz told them not to. Meanwhile, they could pass a bill that says that they can go forward with a lawsuit, but no one who voted on it appears to be aware of what exactly it's going to be suing the president for. They just know that he's deserving of suingness. And Republicans are very upset because Democrats are claiming that Republicans want to impeach the president. And it's the furthest thing from their minds, don't you know? all that and more. And also a story about the scariest candidate for Congress, that a guy who's interviewed 300 candidates in his profession has come across. All that and more, folks. Plus, I will do a play-by-play of the Dick Morris video suggesting that you should sign up to protect your money with Dick Morris. No word on whether or not he promises not to spend it on, well, you know, Dick Morris. You know, I don't know why people forget about Dick Morris. But he's
I think when you look at him and hear his voice, I think it's pretty clear why you may want to forget that, let alone toe-sucking, but that he engages in any type of sexual activity.
Well, you got to hand it. There's definitely, or was, we don't know if this is ongoing, there are definitely some women out there who are earning their money. I got to say that. I
mean, There is a trickle down economy there.
Oh,
but let me make up for that, which was disgusting, and I'll go really pretentious for you for a second. In Flaubert, in Madame Bovary.
I think you'll find it's I think you'll find it's Flaubert.
Flaubert.
Not Flaubert.
Flaubert, excuse me. I did read the book, though. Did you read that book,
no,
Sam?
No, I didn't. Yeah. I just learned the pronunciation. Good.
Oh, well, I don't trust you in pronunciations, but I think you're right on this one.
I only pronounce things in French.
When it comes to English. But he talked about, I think it's a mayor character who sold himself for the pleasure of it. And Dick Morris, there's something like...
I don't think Dick Morris is selling himself for the pleasure
of
it.
Well, no, but he scams for the pleasure of it.
Oh, definitely.
There's just the, like, pure fetishization of immorality around that guy is pretty exceptional.
For him, I think it's just the rush.
Definitely.
He's just looking for the rush.
They think I just write
it's
down
like
several
in the,
retirement
the
accounts.
Sting. I mean, you say Flaubert, I talk about the Sting.
Oh.
I mean, it's quite clear there's some guys who do it not even for the cash. They just do it because they like to get the marks.
Yeah.
And he uses a classic con man tool in this video,
so
and
you,
I will
you,
point it out.
So definitely stay tuned for this, and members will enjoy it. And
for the rest of you, we'll see you tomorrow. Cliff Schechter will be on the program. You can call me at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, of course, you can IM me at Majority FM or on the app, which you can get at majorityapp.com. Thousands of you have already got the app. Use it on a daily basis, and you will note it's completely free. Completely free. All right, folks. Take a quick break. 646-257 is the 257-3920 is the number. You can IM me. Hey, you got a moment? Why not give us a good review on iTunes? Why not tell your friend to subscribe to us on iTunes? We'll be right back after this.